Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Today's program was brought to you by Whole Foods Market. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com. Well, hello, and welcome to Chef's Story, brought to you on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. And I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, the CEO of the International Culinary Center. And today we have one of the biggest chefs around today. It's so exciting. I'm very pleased to welcome to these studios at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, Michael Anthony. You might know him as the executive chef of the fantastic Gramercy Tavern restaurant in New York City. But most importantly this year, Michael won the 2012 Outstanding Chef Award from the James Beard Foundation. What that means, he's like the top chef. Forget about it. He's the top chef. And so we're going to just jump right into it. Michael, welcome.
Hi, Dorothy. Thank you for inviting me to be here today.
Oh, you're really welcome. So, well, I just want to ask you a quick fire question. What was it like to get up on the stage this past May, just a few weeks ago, and receive that award? What was going through your head?
I was really nervous. When your name is called, it seems a little surreal. And I was at the ceremony kind of surrounded by my colleagues, Danny, Paul Bowles-Bevan, Kevin Mahan, Juliette Pope, the sous chefs, my wife, we're all there. We had been in that position before, having been nominated for the category. And it is a bit of a gut-wrenching experience while it's extremely exciting. And I was trying to stay a little calmer than past years. You know, it's you sit on pins and needles while you're waiting for the ceremony to unfold, and having that happen was really one of the most amazing feelings. Mostly because I could get up on the stage and say in front of everyone how thankful I am for the position that I'm in. I got to tell the people that. Some of the people that mean the most to me in my life, what I think about them. And that you don't really get opportunities in life to out loud say those things. There are very few ceremonies that allow us the opportunity to kind of speak out like that in front of a lot of people. And wow, that auditorium was packed. I couldn't quite see our group given the lights. So I read my acceptance speech to Thomas Keller, which I thought that was just fine.
He was sitting in the front row.
We don't know each other that well, but just the same, it was pretty special.
It was a fabulous and a very humble speech, I have to say. You were incredibly gracious. Well, what does it take? We've got a lot of listeners out there, and I just want to get into it saying, what does it take to become the top chef in America? You're a Midwesterner, right?
Yes. Yeah. I grew up in Cincinnati.
And so did you grow up in a food household? Or?
My family is of Italian-American origin, and we had this nostalgia around getting together with family at the table. But it was a working-class family with pretty humble food celebrations. So, yeah, my dad would insist on having Sunday pasta nights, and that my brother and I have a younger brother would sit at the table well through the end of the meal, and we would visit with my grandparents, and we would roll our eyes a lot as young guys that we had to actually do that sort of thing. But yeah, there was a bit of an insistence of kind of being together.
So you had, but you weren't one of those people that grew up on your grandmother's shirt strings or apron strings cooking.
I can't tell that story that at 5 years old I hit that revelation. It didn't happen. My mom was a good cook, and my family family all had great gardens, and that was great. As a kid, I didn't have a special attachment to the kitchen, though.
Okay, so but in your background, what I found interesting is that you went to college and you majored in business.
Yeah.
And in French.
Yeah, I.
And Japanese.
I minored in Japanese. The language part of it came easy. The business part came hard. I had traveled a little bit and lived for a short time outside of Watertown, New York, which is near the Canadian border on the St. Lawrence Seaway, and had visited Montreal a few times and had made some friends. And as a young guy, had that kind of fascination with the French-speaking culture and just trying to connect with those friends. And so that perked my curiosity young, and somehow, you know, all the kind of regular lessons through high school, I took French in high school like a lot of people did. It sunk in, and I had a chance to travel to France a couple times, and I liked the idea of, you know, being able to find a new way to.
So when did the food percolate into your DNA?
It was after I graduated from school. When I graduated from college, the day after I graduated, I moved to Japan. And
why was that?
I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. I knew I wanted to travel. I had a curiosity in exploring Japan, and I wanted to kind of get some practical.
Wait a minute, where did you go to college?
I went to Indiana University.
Okay, and so how did you get this interest in Japan at Indiana University?
I think it came up. I met some Japanese friends when I was traveling in Europe, and we had a couple of long stretches of a bike trip, and they told me a lot about home and kind of fell in love with the idea. And so studied enough Japanese, you know, as part of my undergraduate studies to get a minor. And I wanted to figure out how to use that language. I didn't want to just leave it as some sort of academic study. So I wanted to go and experience living in Japan. I think for probably all the romantic reasons. And when I got there, I picked up a bunch of part-time jobs. I worked in a bakery. I worked on a farm it was this amazing setting on a live volcano in Nagano prefecture. It was actually a dairy farm. There aren't that many dairy farms in that part of Japan. And it was just this amazing rural setting. The family happened to be friends of a friend, and they agreed to give me room and board if I would work on the farm for the summer. And so the morning was filled with chores in the barn, taking care of the dairy cows. And then the afternoon, they supplemented their income by picking flowers and berries on the top of this mountain. It was an incredible scene. And I was thrown into a Japanese-speaking environment with a big family, grandparents, parents, and lots of kids. And so it just was this dream setting for someone that wanted to explore a new culture. I can't say that experience necessarily threw me into a restaurant. That happened later, but it did give me an understanding of what it was like to live in Japan.
But so when did the real serious interest in food start? Did it start via a restaurant, or did you just like eating, or was it working on a farm? Or?
Well, kind of searching back like for those seeds of, you know, when I had this notion of doing it professionally, I knew I had lived in France for a while, and
was that just travel lust?
As a junior in college, okay. I finished that mm-hmm. part of my degree by being in the University of Strasbourg in Alsace, and fell in love with this notion that dining can be an amazingly pleasurable part of your life. Ate in some great restaurants, spent a lot of time with French families and friends eating, but was pretty convinced that not having grown up in a restaurant family and any training or inclination to working in a restaurant, I just thought it wasn't for me at that point. So fast forward, you know, after that summer of working on the farm, I went back to my little one-room apartment outside of Tokyo, and I made contact with Clint Hall, the food critic for the Herald Tribune, the English-speaking newspaper in Tokyo at that time. And he was kind enough to introduce me to a chef by the name of Shizuyo Shima, who was a woman chef and restaurant owner, very rare thing in Tokyo. She had this jewel-like restaurant that had about 25 seats and her in the kitchen. And I explained, you know, that I had an interest in learning about cooking professionally. My plan was actually, to go to cooking school in Japan.
Really? Where were you going to go?
I wanted to go to Tsuji Cooking School.
Oh, I love Mr. Tsuji.
And I had to improve my Japanese speaking skills and then have, you know, practical experience before doing that. I spent about a year working in her restaurant, and it was a very difficult experience. Wow. I thought it would just be here in this beautiful little restaurant, me, the chef, what an ideal learning experience. Well, what I learned from Shima was working in a restaurant is not all fun and not all that glamorous. That if you really want to do it well, it's you know, there was a gritty side to the business.
How big a restaurant was it?
It was very small. It was in the heart of Roppongi, which at that time was a little bit of an international center for Tokyo. Now it has exploded and it's very, very cosmopolitan. But at that point, it was a residential neighborhood. It was this favorite, charming restaurant. And in a lot of ways, it's ironic that it had a lot of similarities to March Restaurant, another place that I worked here in the city. It felt like you were walking into someone's home as you entered, and it literally had about 25, 28 seats, depending on how we configured it. There was one server and the chef in the kitchen, and she taught me so much about the foundation of cooking and the basics of loving working in a restaurant that I find myself using either expressions or saying things that she told me.
For example?
Think ahead when you're working. Think three steps ahead. A good chef always knows what's going to happen three steps ahead of when it actually happens. Choose the right tool for a job. You know, think about the size pot you need or which knife will accomplish this job. You know, keep your station clean, keep the kitchen clean. One of my jobs on Friday night was literally to crawl into the grease pit and scrub it with a hand brush. I kind of, looking back on it, think that it was a little bit of boot camp, and she was testing to see, you know.
How long did you work there?
I was there for about a year, and this was in the early 90s.
That's a long time.
So it was a long time, and someone asked me recently, a close family friend said, so, you know, you had this illustrious start cooking in Japan, and what a way to get a career started. And I really, looking back on it, we can say that that was the inspiration that pushed me forward, and it certainly provided me with the tools for the job that I do every day. But I didn't know if I was going to survive it. In the time that it was happening to me, I did not know that Chef Shima was helping me or in the process of killing me.
So you also worked in some of the greatest restaurants in France.
I finally ended up, after a year of working with Shima, she said, listen, you're from the West. If you love Japan that much, you can come back. But you have to go to cooking school. I've taught you everything I know. She had gone to Ferrandi.
She did.
And
okay.
So there's an interesting connection.
All right.
Here.
The connection is, you know, the International Culinary Center was founded as the French Culinary Institute. And the French Culinary Institute did not spring like Phoenix from nothing. It sprung from this phenomenal school in Paris, Ferrandi. And very few Americans were adventurous enough to go over to Paris and actually do the Ferrandi course. And Michael's one of them. No wonder you're such a powerhouse chef. So how'd you get to Ferrandi?
Well, it was really Shima that said she was one of the very first international students that the school had ever seen. So she had gone to school there in the late 70s and followed up by working for a famous chef named Jean de Laven, who is really of a generation that we have very little contact with these days. But when I moved to Paris on her advice to go to school, she came and introduced me to Monsieur de Laven. And he was at the end of his career and had started a restaurant. He was no longer working in his famous 3 Michelin star restaurant, Le Camélia, but had gone into a project with a famous pastry chef named Jean Billet, and their restaurant was called Le Regain, and it had a short life, but it was a chance for me to get started in cooking school and have a part-time job. She sat me down over lunch to meet him, and I was scared to death. He's a chef that it was notorious for his his temperament, his difficult.
I've met him actually.
and so, you know, early on I didn't understand why or how things worked in the kitchen, but the sous chef actually wore soccer shin guards.
Oh my gosh. I've never heard that before.
He found out that things were going wrong in the restaurant. They were usually kicks to the shin.
Oh my gosh. So it was
one of those very old school places, but as a young guy getting started in the business, it couldn't have been more challenging. And you know, I was kind of living day to day, penny to penny. I had just saved enough money to kind of get myself there and get going. Not that I was being paid any money in the restaurant, but it was certainly an eye-opening experience to life of working in the restaurant business in Paris. So that was, she came again later just to make sure that I was being serious and not
in Paris
wasting my time. She came twice to Paris to follow up and make sure I wasn't wasting my
time. Okay, well, speaking of time, we're going to have to take a break here. But we're going to come back and see how all that translates into Gramercy Tavern. So here we go.
Market. We review each and every product that hits our shelves. Our cleaning products are no exception. Our EcoScale ranking system rates each household cleaner so you know what you're getting. Now, during Earth Month and any time of the year, learn more at WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Okay, welcome back. This is Chef's Story. And I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and I'm speaking today to the superstar chef Michael Anthony of Gramercy Tavern and the most recent winner of the James Beard Outstanding Chef Award. And we've just finished his sort of whirlwind apprenticeship in between Japan and France, and I don't know how we're going to leapfrog to Gramercy Tavern, because I definitely want to get there in your iconic way of cooking there. But tell me, so here you were in France, you went to cooking school in Paris, and you've come back. How did you negotiate the restaurants in New York? Did you know you wanted to be a chef? Was that, you know, how did that sort of manifest?
Yeah, by the time I was headed back to New York, I had worked in five different restaurants in France, kind of scattered around the country, and I was definitely hooked. I was lucky enough to have a chef make a phone call to Daniel Boulou, and when I arrived in New York, there was a spot waiting for me in his restaurant when the restaurant was located on 76th Street, so I had a chance to... That was my first experience working in New York City, and I had never even visited New York City, so I was sufficiently intimidated by working in his kitchen and just, you know, getting set up in the city.
After Tokyo and Paris?
Well, it was a new adventure. And, it's interesting when growing up in the United States outside of New York City, we grow up with this cultural knowledge of New York and New York culture. But I felt really intimidated. I was intimidated because there was a fire escape that led to the sidewalk, and I was sure someone was coming through my window every night. I was intimidated by the fast, intense pace of restaurant life. We had 80 seats in that restaurant, two teams, a day team and a night team. I had never seen anything like that. Mm-hmm. I'd never worked in a restaurant that big. Mm-hmm. On a Saturday night, we would do 240 covers. Mm-hmm. And I remembered, the difference between life and death hinged between 58 and 64 covers at restaurants that I had worked in France. So I didn't have any experience at working at that volume level and at that speed. And it was an eye-opening experience.
So let's quickly go through the restaurants that you did work in, and then I need to get into Gramercy Tavern and what you're doing there.
So I got lucky at every step of the way, kind of diving in and in over my head. And I had a chance to work as a sous chef and later the chef de cuisine at March Restaurant. I worked at both Blue Hill in the city and... was able to be part of the opening team at Blue Hill at Stone Barns. Mm. And then I set out to open my own restaurant, and a conversation with Danny Meyer turned in a different direction, and I had the opportunity to come and join the team at Gramercy Tavern. I've been there for 6 years now.
6 years. So how did that conversation, you wanted to open your own restaurant, and now you've joined a group of restaurants, maybe the premier group of restaurants in the United States. And so how did you make that decision?
Danny helped quite a bit formulate the business plan for, you know, the kind of fledgling ideas that I had about a small restaurant. He taught me a lot of good lessons early on in terms of thinking about scale. Every young chef, examples.
Maybe.
It's ironic because we just visited the new space, Blanca, that has 12 seats. And
right.
Recently, chefs have been able to shatter the notion of scale by opening minuscule jewel box restaurants. But the reality of it is that, you know, every young chef is dreaming of being able to control the style of their cooking in a very small setting. Yet the business, if you really want to take care of a large group of people and take care of them well in terms of salary and in terms of benefits and longevity, to get ahead in terms of business, then scale is really important. Everyone sets out opening a restaurant with a goal in mind, and some of those are purely artistic. Others are kind of leapfrogging, hoping for a better opportunity, finding investors, and then some restaurants are set up to last a lifetime. And Gramercy Tavern is one of them. It's a restaurant that was built to endure, you know, years and years, and it evolves with the way people use it. It's a foundation. It's a kind of platform that has a point of view and a very specific culture, but it's built to change.
Right. Gramercy Tavern, as many people know, was open probably 12 years ago. For how many years has it
18
been?
18.
Oh, yeah. Gosh, time flies when it's really good. And Tom Colicchio was the first chef. But Tom Colicchio is just a totally different chef than you are. And so he put his mark on it. But today, Gramercy Tavern, to me, is a totally different restaurant, you know, if you go to eat the food. And you have just been honored by your peers as the greatest chef in the United States. How does that translate into the plate? What is Gramercy Tavern today? And what is the restaurant to you? Because you have made your mark on it.
Well, I think there are two basic notions that are important in understanding the restaurant today. And that is, first of all, in terms of recognizing the staff, my goal is to create more avenues than roadblocks. There are talented people that come our way with tons of potential. They're not always the most experienced cooks, but they're people that have interesting backgrounds and they're full of potential. They have a sense of beauty. Most everyone that we hire has a sense of beauty is kind of a delicate word, but it's a sense of taste that comes from their you know, their background. I can't really teach that. I can teach folks how to become proficient line cooks and can teach them ways and to work together effectively. But we're always looking for people that come into the restaurant with a sense of connection to the world around them, to ingredients. I think the other important mission of the restaurant is to tell a story through its ingredients. And it's fantastic because the Gramercy Tavern is founded on belonging to its community. A tavern in concept would have always been connected to its local sources. This is a chance to, you know, to run with that theme. And in New York City, we could tell our story in any way that we want. We could pick up the phone and have any ingredient from anywhere in the world tomorrow. But I feel like our story is so much stronger when we're expressing it through the ingredients and not only technique. And we're telling that story through ingredients that are connected to us culturally and literally connected because they're grown.
Okay, this is I'm going to try to go after something elusive here, because there are many restaurants that say they're farm to table, and they are, you know, and there are many proficient and really great chefs who get the technique down. But you have that third quality to take it from, you know, really great meal to a celestial meal. And so I'm kind of trying to get, I know you're great with your staff and you promote them and you're a great leader, but what is Michael Anthony on the plate when it comes out?
I look back at the food memories that I have and the meals that have stayed with me over, you know, the years and my life, and I recognize that there were a couple of key components that really all come down to trying to, you know, our effort is to try to create these food memories, long-lasting food memories. And specifically in my style, that has to do with every chef will say we cook simple food or we have simplified the kind of cooking that we do. But when I say we cook simple food, it's not to make it approachable or universally popular. It's mostly to make it so that it creates this indelible image in your mind. Simple to me means unforgettable, and also ties in with the general aesthetic of I've always loved dishes that tend to be under manipulated. I mentioned that we really are not striving. While we're progressive in our thinking, searching through all of our travels for ingredients that have marked us and, you know, as chefs make us excited. And I say us because it's a collaborative effort at the restaurant. The sous chefs are very much involved in this process. Even line cooks are very much involved in it. But so while we're telling the story through local ingredients, we're not kind of shutting ourselves off. We're not creating blinders to interesting and progressive ideas that you know, take birth outside of our immediate area. We're not excluding ourselves from ingredients that make our dishes better.
Can you give me a for instance?
Well, I tend to lean towards, you know, some Japanese ingredients that that if handled in a certain way, you could look at it, if they're handled in a clumsy way or in a not a very thoughtful way, you could look at it and just say this is fusion food. If you interject ingredients or ideas from an outside culture and do it in another setting and try to blend it, it becomes fusion. And, you know, we've seen that at least that for me, doesn't necessarily create a long-lasting memory. It might be a fun meal on a particular night, but it won't endure. The way I tend to lean towards essential ingredients that, you know, for example, kombu and katsuobushi are, you know, the foundation of Japanese cooking. And when I lived in Japan, I learned about the specific places that they come from, which draws an interesting connection back to the way we cook in our American style, as we're starting to, not for pretension or exclusivity, we're starting to focus on sourcing in a way that is connected specifically to the place where we're cooking. I live in New York. I want to tell a story that's connected to the Northeast. What's different about eating in New York versus San Francisco or Paris or Tokyo? If I lived in any of those other places, the style of food that I cook would be different. The ingredients that I use would be different. And especially the rhythm and the flow through the year would be entirely different. So we're searching for I'm hitting on the second point of what I think distinguishes our cooking at GT is what is specifically distinct about our place. So we've talked about food that's under manipulated or simple enough to remember at the end of a great meal. It's not really good enough for us to leave folks who eat at GT saying, wow, everything I tasted was wonderful. You guys used the best ingredients. I'd like for people to remember I had a meal in late spring in which you used asparagus or, you know, the year's first peas or, you know, a specific ingredient that you can't lose. You just can't, you know, get your mind off of. So we have this simple approach. We have this idea of it being connected culturally to a particular place. And I think all of the, when you have a meal that's anchored to a specific time and a specific place, and it is also, I guess the last element of this is when it's connected to that particular time of the year, a specific season, then it becomes one of those long-lasting memories. So we're in the business of now more than ever in the restaurant, while we're adding to the story that has been put in front of us, a beautiful stage to talk about American cooking. We're adding on to, we're evolving what Gramercy Tavern has always stood for in terms of creating a standard of American dining. We're seeing how the aesthetic of that American dining is evolving. Now more than ever, we're talking about a very distinct way of eating, both at Gramercy Tavern and having Gramercy Tavern add a very specific voice to what it means to kind of cook American food.
Okay.
Today.
All right. Well, we're going to come back to that. We're going to have to take a short break here, but I want to get into the future.
Thank you.
Welcome back. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, the CEO of the International Culinary Center, and we're on Chef Story. And today, our very special guest is Michael Anthony, the executive chef of Gramercy Tavern restaurant in New York City, and the 2012 Outstanding Chef, that means top chef, by the James Beard Foundation. And we've just gone through history and really full essence of his restaurant, Gramercy Tavern. And I kind of want to pick up there again and say, you know, here you are in one of the top culinary cities in the world. You have access to every single kind of ingredient you can possibly want. You have a very sophisticated clientele. You probably can get any cook in the world to come and cook with you, and the staff, you know, are knocking on your door. Where do you want to go? You're a young chef. Where in 5 years? Where is cooking evolving? Where is your cooking evolving? Where is Gramercy Tavern evolving?
Gramercy Tavern is on its own is probably a lifetime of work. I mean, for everyone who has eaten there, you know how it's really like operating two restaurants at once. So we certainly have our hands full, and every day, week, and month feels like, you know, our checklist on improvements is a mile long. So in and of itself, it's quite a dream to work in a restaurant where people come to work every day and they have the courage to say, we're really proud of what we do. Let's try to make this a little bit better. So that's a unique work environment. There is a sense of, education that is now part of the DNA of that restaurant. It has always been connected to the communal spirit of, I think, all of Danny's restaurants. But Gramercy Tavern acts as a bit of a graduate school in terms of graduating great people. And so we have had a great run in the last couple of years, seeing young chefs that have worked with me in the kitchen and have gone on to spread their wings and
if I can just say something, you are one of the greatest mentors in the world, I think, for young cooks. I know you just mentored Rose Weiss, who won the cooking Bocuse d'Or Commis competition. Yeah. And she couldn't have done it without you. And well, that you actively, I mean, a lot of chefs, you know, like La Camellia chef, he probably had people in his kitchen and you kind of learnt by default, you know, but you actively nurture your people.
Well, yeah, I've noticed that in this business, for some strange reason, I mentioned it earlier, I think we tend to set up more roadblocks than we do kind of create avenues for people. And I know that along the way, some folks helped me through mentoring me and even sometimes with just great suggestions, but they gave me the time and the energy. And I feel like if I can do anything to say thank you for what happened to me, I can do that for somebody else.
So I know that you're going to be educating the world now because you're coming out with the Gramercy Tavern Cookbook.
Yes.
Right. So tell me about that. What's the momentum for that cookbook?
Well, it's been an amazing learning process. We are writing the story of Gramercy Tavern, and that is going to be an amazing read for everyone who has loved the restaurant for years, for everyone who's excited to learn about where the restaurant is headed, to get a behind-the-scenes look at the people and, you know, this institution. It's going to be a dense, rich book filled with pictures that will look gorgeous, you know, sitting on your coffee table. But at the same time, we set out from the very beginning to say that we wanted it to play a dual function, that not only should it look great and make us feel proud as a team to kind of recognize our work in beautiful pictures and writing, but we want it to be a book that people will cook from. Mm-hmm. We're using, you know, the standard of the Union Square Cafe cookbook, which is a beloved cookbook. And if you look on so many people's kitchens at home, they have it handy. It's a used book. So we want for this also to, you know, to play that role, to be a book that people will kind of not only cherish, but use.
You want it stained.
So I was really, that's
right.
Funny. It's funny because
I
say yes, but here's one of the things I would like for people to do with this book. And this, here's how I use cookbooks. I read them, I close them, and then I cook and I change things. And I deviate from the process. Granted, I do this for a living, so I might have a few more tools, but I hope that people at home, no matter what their skill level is, will kind of take the book for that value. There are some inspired ideas. I'd like for it to hopefully influence the way they choose their ingredients and the way they go about, you know, setting up their kitchen and certainly the dishes that they serve to their families and friends. But I hope that they'll end up closing that book and setting it aside so it may not get the sauce stains on it. Not to protect it, but simply to hope, you know, encourage people to cook from their own intuition.
So what's still an exciting thing that you haven't done yet with food? Not cooking, but maybe even a journey of eating somewhere or tasting something. What are some of the, not challenges, but things you still want to do?
Well, keeping Gramercy Tavern relevant is probably our number one passion. Any business, especially a restaurant business, is a dynamic entity. It's not a piece of art. You can't just finish it, put it on the wall, and keep it dusted and well lit for people to appreciate. It changes with the way our guests and the way our staff use it. So keeping it relevant means, how do we search for new ideas? How are we evolving as cooks? And this, I have two great trips that are planned for this year. I'll get to visit Blackberry Farm for the first time with a group from the James Beard Foundation.
Tell us about Blackberry Farm.
Blackberry Farm is a wonderful restaurant and resort in eastern Tennessee. Mm-hmm. It's a working farm as well as a great getaway. Mm-hmm. It's a Relais Chateau property with a fantastic dynamic working team in the kitchen and in the gardens. They produce wonderful foods, and we'll get together to have a symposium on food policy and to do some collaborative cooking and hopefully get our hands dirty a little bit in the garden. Mm. So I'm looking forward to that being an inspiring trip. I hope that I'll be able to discover some new plants and varieties. We're always on the search for new things that we can encourage our favorite growers here to plant. Mm-hmm. We're waiting for some seeds.
Do you work with farmers directly that they're planting for you? And
yeah, most of our food comes directly from the Union Square Green Market, and now the Grow NYC has created the wholesale green market, which is located in Long Island City. That operation could very well change the history. Could
Why?
Very well change the face of the way we buy food in New York City. Well, it's an extension of the green market and the green market network. It's owned and operated by the city-sponsored organization Grow NYC, and we're really seeing the birth of a healthy, dynamic wholesale operation, which for years and years, for all of us who either shop personally or for our restaurants at a green market, and in our neighborhood, that's Union Square, we've played that game of grabbing as many bags as we can and throwing them in a taxi and racing back to the kitchen. Or in our case, I feel lucky because I work with an all-star team, and Modesto Batista is a New York iconic figure. And you see him with his, hybridized wheelbarrow rolling in and out of the green market. Everyone sees Modesto and the seas part, right?
Yeah,
he's attached to the market. So that's where most of our ingredients come from. But we've also seen that we want to figure out how slightly larger restaurants or larger operations can buy on a larger scale. The green market is wonderful and deserves all of our support. But how do we get more local foods involved in restaurants and institutions? So we're really just seeing the birth of this this idea that's been on the table for years now. They found the right location, and they have the right money backing it. And now we're going through the growing process of figuring out how to set up a system that works. So, but outside of that, yes, I think this is a way that the restaurant will continue to evolve, is how can we play a role model in terms of how the restaurant connects outside the four walls of the restaurant in order to source food.
And so a lot of chefs, picking up on that point, start second and third restaurants, sometimes bistros or, something a little more casual. Is that anything that interests you?
Well, it's a little premature to to discuss, but I'll say that we have such an amazing core team right now at Gramercy Tavern. And whenever you feel this mass of talent and more than talent, this this kind of tight connection of people, we have the opportunity to start to dream a little bit. And so we'll see how that evolves in the future. But, we definitely have the luxury of being able to dream not only about food, but the setting in which we might serve it.
As an educator, because a chef is, you have to kind of teach your kitchen. We don't have much time left. I'd like you to think about two groups of people to talk to. If you could say something, not to thank them. You thank everybody all the time. But this is to really say, this is how I hope you will grow. One is your client who eats at Gramercy Tavern. And the other is the group of people who want to become a chef and have that dream. What are two things you can say to them to help them move to a new level mm-hmm. of experience?
Well, I'll start with the young cooks out there. I think that moving forward in this business takes, obviously, this is an obvious answer. It takes discipline and persistence. You identify what you love to do, recognize that that is a gift to be able to lead your life and follow your calling. I certainly feel lucky that I was able to do that in my lifetime. Secondly, along the way, you have to recognize what makes you unique. So while you're growing up in kitchens and learning a new set of technical skills and constantly feel, no matter where you get into the business, whether you're a career changer or just graduating from high school, it's important to recognize your differences. We feel really self-conscious of our weak spots as we grow up in kitchens, and we get criticized for those things. It's a pressure-filled environment. But those differences, and sometimes even those weaknesses, turn into your greatest strength because it defines who you are. Mm-hmm. So I think as young cooks are growing in the kitchen and applying themselves to being disciplined and persistent, they should also be searching for what are their unique qualities and characters. In terms of our guests, you know, I think we see it happening. I love it when our guests want to get more information. They want to get behind the scenes. They want to know what makes us crazy about the ingredients that we serve and the things that we do to them. So I think the current amount of information that's available on the internet, on radio, on TV is a fascinating process, and we have an amazing story to tell at Gramercy Tavern. I love it when people level those questions, whether it's tableside or they take time to stay after a meal and visit the kitchen. Mm-hmm. In some senses, you know, we've always seen that behind every chef there's a show off, but in our case, I think we have a story to tell.
Yeah.
And so I think as a dining community, we benefit by living in New York, where we have a very knowledgeable and intense dining community. But as they reach out for more and expect more of restaurants, they should. I hope that they'll want to know, you know, the story behind the scenes and have high expectations of restaurants that they eat in. Where does that food come from, and what makes it so special?
Well, I just want to say that if anybody wants a special meal and has not been to Gramercy Tavern, it's a lifetime pleasure, and you will have indelible memories. Michael, I want to thank you for taking time off from your very busy schedule to come out and talk with us. And I want to thank Jack Inslee, our producer, and a shout out to Heidi Tickle and Joe Sevier, who are my assistant producers. And we'll see you next time on Chef Story. Thank you.
Thanks, Dorothy.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.